Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable, where we invite you to a critical conversation with journalists about the week's news and news media. 1 week ago, the Dow Jones Index for the New York Stock Exchange dropped over 500 points, joining precipitous declines in markets from Frankfurt to Shenzhen. On Monday, the drops when the markets opened were even sharper. Hundreds of headlines proclaimed Black Monday, and analysts scrambled to explain what caused the panic. The slowing Chinese economy, the Fed's long-awaited increase in interest rates, maybe the fact that consumers just about everywhere don't seem to have that much money to spend. But if you look at news sites and papers this morning, you'd see little indication of the panic earlier in the week. The markets have gained back much of the ground they'd lost, and the latest economic reports from the federal government show the U.S. economy growing in the second quarter at a stronger rate of 3.7%, while claims for first-time unemployment benefits are down more than expected. So did the crisis that generated so much attention just days ago mean anything at all? To what extent does the conversation spawned by the market scare tell us about what's happening in the real economy, especially for the majority of Americans who have no stake whatsoever in the stock market? With us for the hour on today's Media Roundtable are two reporters who spend their days trying to understand the global economy and explain it to readers. David Diane is a contributing writer to Salon.com and a weekly columnist at the Fiscal Times. You can also see his reporting in The New Republic, The American Prospect, Politico, and David joins us from Los Angeles. Good to have you with us, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And in Washington, D.C., we welcome back Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
And we want you to join the conversation. Was there an exemplary piece of reporting you read or heard or watched this week that you want to highlight? What did you make of the wall-to-wall coverage of the stock market drop? And what questions did it raise for you about how the news media covers the economy? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can call 866-798-8255. We always welcome new callers, people with perspectives that we haven't heard on the program. And also, we love it if you talk about specifics of what you saw, whether the excellent coverage or coverage that fell short. The number to call again is 866-798-TALK. And we also welcome your comments and questions on our website, yourcallradio.org. So every week on the Your Call Media Roundtable, we begin our discussion by asking the journalists on our panel to talk about a piece of reporting or analysis they thought was particularly well done this week. David Diane, let's start with you. What did you see that you'd like to direct our attention to?
Yeah, there was a spectacular expose in the Washington Post by Terrence McCoy, and it was about this secondary market in what are called structured settlements. So if insurance companies make a settlement with an aggrieved party, they will often make them in a series of payments, say 400 payments over a number of years. And there are these companies that come in and offer lump sums in exchange for those structured settlements, and usually it's pennies on the dollar. And in this case, McCoy was talking about companies who go into poor communities, particularly victims of lead poisoning, and offer them very low amounts. And these are people that read and at grade school levels often, and they are duped into signing these agreements to give away their structured settlement for very low money. It was an excellent story, and it shows just all the facets of corruption within that system.
And so talk a little bit more about kind of the details of how are they finding these people that they want to kind of target for these, mm-hmm. for this kind of thing, and then what happens?
Yeah, well, they find them through there are records, court records. That are usually these settlements go through the judicial system in one way or another, and typically the courts have to agree to allow this transaction. And there's one judge in Baltimore. This story focuses on Baltimore and particularly lead poisoning. There's one judge who, time after time, is rubber stamping these payouts of these structured settlements. And his name comes up again and again and again, and so it shows that in many ways the judicial system is culpable in allowing this to continue.
So that's Terrence McCoy of the Washington Post. The title of the article is, the headline is, How Companies Make Millions Off Lead-Poisoned and Poor Blacks. Thank you for pointing that out, David Diane. Kevin Hall, what did you see this week that impressed you?
Well, two things. One was just a smart think piece in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week, a front page story by Greg Ipp and Bob Davis, that just kind of laid out the origins and the limits in this whole mess of how China got here, but also some of the constraints and challenges of China going forward. So it wasn't particularly investigative or anything of that sort, but it was just a real smart overview that I think hit all the bases. And the other one was a Wall Street Journal story today about a hacker, a British citizen, and an Islamic State hacker who was killed in a drone strike. And it's a fascinating story because when you think about drone strikes and military combatants, you think of them, you know, blowing up bus stations and on the battlefield, not a hacker on a laptop, and raises questions about whether that's really a military threat, et cetera. A fascinating story and the ongoing drama over drone strikes and the gray area that involves drone strikes.
Explain more about when you say, what role did the hacker play for people who haven't read this story?
He had hacked into military personnel files and U.S. generals, I presume, and certainly top-level officials and public, and released to others to publish data that was not necessarily flattering. So it wasn't necessarily going after war-related stuff, but some of it was just embarrassing personal information that they released.
So this is a piece called Hacker Killed by Drone Was Islamic State's Secret Weapon. We'll post that along with the other recommendations from Kevin Hall and David Diane at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are here on the Your Call Media Roundtable, and you mentioned, Kevin, that, you know, talking about the slowdown in the Chinese economy, kind of where that stands. I definitely want to talk more about that later. But first, I just want to ask a broad question of both of you. You know, 4 days ago, looking at the major news sites, you kind of thought that the sky was falling when it came to certainly with the stock markets, but also kind of for what that meant for the global economy. I mean, in some of the follow-up coverage, I think there's some recognition. I think of NPR yesterday had a story on All Things Considered where the basic idea was the stock market is not the economy. But at these moments where there are these market downturns, you'd think that wasn't the case. You'd think that, in fact, not only was the economy, it might actually be the whole country. And David Diame, we start with you. Talk about why do you think that kind of blanket coverage happens, and you know, what kind of questions is raised for you about how the financial and economic press works?
Sure. It's a pretty easy indicator. It's constantly changing. It's very dynamic. You can put the ticker at the bottom of the screen, and you can watch it go up and down. And so for particularly cable news and business news, it's an easy way, shorthand, to try to track the economy. But you're right. I mean, you go out on the street and go into a park and ask 10 people if they own individual stocks, 9 people will say no. So it has a tangential relationship to the economy, but it really is just a shorthand. And instead of hiring reporters to go out and really try to figure out what is happening in the economy, it's a little bit easier sometimes to put up a stock ticker and say, well, it's going down, so the sky's falling. Meanwhile, the stocks are up for the week, as you mentioned, and most of the losses of the past several days have been gained back on the U.S. side. So I just think it's an easy way to get around the diligence and time it takes to really report what is going on in the economy.
So, Kevin, this is one of those moments when the economy becomes kind of an event rather than a trend or, you know, a tendency, or, you know, something really long term. I think that's part of what David's talking about. Is there anything you'd add about why you think there could be such a rush to cover this like this and make it such a big deal, and kind of what the pros and cons of that?
Yeah, I think part of it is simply the number sounds big. You hear an 800-point drop or a 1,000-point drop, and that sounds like a giant number, and it is. But in percentage terms, it actually was a small number compared to prior drops, like the close in the 1987 crisis, long-term capital management. I think it was a 500-point swing, but it was 22% of the market or something like that. So, you know, so the point thing is part of it. I'm guessing. But I'll push back a little bit on this idea that the stock market and the economy are separate entities. Stocks tend to reflect views of where the economy will be roughly 6 months from now, and they reflect, you know, company earnings and things that are real signs of the economy. But where the disconnect is, in my mind, is that so much of this is algorithmic program trading, which has nothing to do with supply-demand, but has to do with movements within numbers that computers pick up, and then it suddenly becomes very disconnected for the average person, for sure.
So when the
Can I just jump in real quick? I agree that stock markets are following trends in the future. I don't think they're necessarily following economic trends in the future, but they're looking at trends of expected future corporate profits,
right,
6 months down the road. And I think that is somewhat of a different thing from the economy. I mean, certainly what we've seen over the last 30, 40 years is that corporate profits don't necessarily track wages. So for an individual worker, whether or not corporate profits are going to do well in the next 6 months doesn't necessarily bear resemblance to whether their pocketbooks are going to look pretty good. So that's why I think there's a further disconnect between the stock market and the economy.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, Kevin, when you think about the conversation that, you know, all the analysis that was spurred by this moment in time on the stock markets around the world, what do you think was really important in terms of understanding what happened there? And then, you know, what kind of interesting conversation analysis did you see come out about the global economy this week spurred by this?
Well, I do think there are real structural weaknesses in the global economy, and I think that's part of what's driving this. But I think the other thing that I think the average person may not pick up on is just how unusual a time we are in. The Federal Reserve is talking about raising its benchmark rate. It hasn't raised it in almost a decade. It's been near zero since 2008. That we know, but the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, every major bank in monetary institution in the world has kept interest rates. There's never been a time in modern history where we've had all banks coordinating the same way to try to provide some sugar high to financial markets to kind of fight off deflation, the opposite of inflation. And so I think we're in a really unusual time, and I think that's part of the market volatility too. As things get repriced, as the Fed starts kind of bringing interest rates back up to where we start looking like we did 10 years ago, some resemblance to normalcy, then everything has to get repriced, rethought. And I think it's going to be very bumpy for the next several years.
David Diane, what would you add?
Yeah, I think that idea of liftoff, that whether or not the Fed will try to, quote, return to normalcy and when, is a key question. You know, the Fed has this meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming every year, and they're out there today. There were some groups. There's a group from the left called Fed Up that is trying to forestall a rate hike. This volatility in the market may end up putting off what was expected as a rate hike in September. And, you know, I would say that it's unclear whether that rate hike is necessary, considering that inflation has been below target of the Federal Reserve for 3 years. And the reason, the normal rationale for a rate hike would be to tamp down inflation, and we just don't see that. The secondary reason is to ensure that you have maybe a little cushion if the economy does go into a slowdown. If we end up into an economic downturn and the Federal Reserve is already at zero on their interest rate, they don't really have much other places to go. They can use quantitative easing and things like that, but that is a place that we have not found ourselves in quite a while, with you know, this very low interest rate environment and monetary policy not having a lot of tools. And if there is a downturn, I think that's more the concern of central bankers at this point, that if the economy goes south, they won't really have a lot of tools in their arsenal to counteract that.
You know, one of the things about with all the focus on the Fed and will it raise its rates by, you know, the certain amount, it seems to me also that, I mean, the other tool that the federal government has to potentially support growth is stimulus of some kind, right?
Absolutely.
And that seems to have just kind of that I guess because it's seen as a political impossibility, that's not even part of the conversation. I just thought it was interesting reading coverage of China and its economy and the role that the Communist Party and the government there is playing in trying to push or slow down the economy. In some ways, I think there's a lot more open discussion about, oh, what are the forces, determining where China's economy is going than there are about the potential of what might happen in the United States along the same lines. David or Kevin, feel free to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about fiscal policy and that being the other and maybe the more stable lever that could be used. I wrote a piece this week about the fact that at the same time that there was the stock market volatility, the 10-year Treasury bond rate was hovering around 2%, which means that investors all over the world were cramming into Treasury bonds and willing to have the federal government borrow money at 2% over 10 years. This is a gift horse that we've been looking in the mouth for several years now.
Explain why.
Because we're essentially being told that the government can borrow money almost at a negative interest rate. It's like free money. And it could be used to boost fiscal spending, and there certainly are projects of need out there in the country with respect to infrastructure or whether it's roads or water systems or internet access or what have you. And we could do it at a very cheap rate. We're going to have to do it at some point down the line as systems break down and crumble. We're seeing those systems already crumble in many respects in some parts. And so fiscal policy would be an excellent way to boost aggregate demand, which is still below trend where the economy should be. But that argument is kind of taken off the table by a Congress that really just doesn't seem interested in it.
That's David Dayan. I'll be right back to you, Kevin. David Dayan is a contributing writer to Salon.com, weekly columnist to the Fiscal Times. Also with us today on Your Call, Kevin Hall, chief economics correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Friday Media Roundtable, where we talk about coverage of major stories of the week and how the news media did well or not well in explaining them to us. If you would like to join the conversation, we welcome your call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you want to talk about financial and economic coverage from the week, you're welcome to join the conversation. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Kevin, you wanted to get in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say the opposite of the stimulus issue is the debt held by the public, which is roughly 78%, I think, of our overall economy. So that's more than twice the historical level. And if the president's budget were passed, it would stay there for the next 10 years. If the Republicans' budget was passed, it would get there. It would get half, and still be in the 48-50%. But any way you look at it, our percentage of debt that we have leaves you so vulnerable in future crises. I mean, I think that's part of the issue. But we are refinancing now. We have been every time we have the debt limit debate, and we have been refinancing effectively with these low borrowing costs. So it has been a tremendous shock absorber for keeping things much worse than they would have been, much worse than they would have been. Forgive me.
Yeah. I want to bring in William in Belvedere, who's called into the program. William, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you very much. Financial things are always so difficult to understand. I have this question. Is it that the government is able to set the interest rates? I do know that the Federal Reserve can, by putting money in, adjust the rates for overnight borrowing by the banks by making more money available. But I don't see, since that's just for overnight rates, where one bank borrows from another, I don't see how that affects the interest rates for longer periods of time.
Great question, William. Let's get an answer from David or Kevin. You guys go ahead.
Kevin, you want to check in?
Okay.
I can.
Yeah, in the simplest sense, it's a target rate. It's not actually an enforceable rate. It's a target. It's where the Fed would like to see that cost. and then there's price referencing off that across the economy. It isn't guaranteed, but it's certainly the way it has worked. The flip side of that, of course, is we remember the LIBOR scandal, in which some of these rates weren't being set the way we thought they were being set, but were set to reference other prices for the benefit of these big banks. So I don't know if I've answered a question with a question.
I would just add a couple things. One, in anticipation of this fiscal tightening, in anticipation of these raising rates, we're already seeing long-term rates go up, at least slightly, if not even longer so, within the economy. So the Federal Reserve plays a key role just by signaling, and that signaling is already starting to sort of bear fruit with higher long-term interest rates. The other thing is, more recently, the way the Federal Reserve has considered managing the federal funds rate and the overnight lending rate, and will continue to do so, is that they give interest to banks on reserves, the reserves that they hold and park at the Federal Reserve. And the rationale here is that if they set that interest on reserves just a little bit higher than the rate that banks use to lend to one another, then they can manage that federal funds rate a little bit better. So, but that's something to think about, that every time the Federal Reserve raises the federal funds rate, they're going to raise that interest on reserve rate, and banks are going to be able to earn money from just leaving their reserves at the Fed.
Let's bring in John in San Francisco, who wants to join the conversation. John, welcome to the program.
Good morning. As your guests know, there are ways to bet for and against the market by placing certain investments in puts and calls. And my question is whether or not there are groups of people, such as hedge fund managers, who gain at the volatility of the market, and whether or not they have any influence on the volatility, such as the big downturn that we recently incurred.
Kevin?
I think there's some degree of impact on this trading, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has been studying this issue pretty carefully. I think in the flash crash, there was one subsequent to the flash crash, there was a mini crash in which there's been accusations that it was trading in one platform designed to trigger movements in another. And I do think this high speed, I would highly recommend to your listeners to read Michael Lewis's book Flash Boys, to look at and to understand the philosophy of these high frequency traders, these high speed traders, and how these systems are being established, and then ask yourself what this has to do with price discovery, which is what usually is part of the equation, and what it has to do at all to the economy. So I do think that's a very, very real concern.
That's Kevin Hall. He's chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Also with us on today's media roundtable here on Your Call is David Diane, who's a contributing writer to Salon.com and a weekly columnist at the Fiscal Times. We are talking about coverage of economic and financial news following the big coverage this week of the Chinese economic slowdown and the market crashes earlier in the week that have now recovered. And one thing in specific we want to talk about in the second half, in addition to China and what's happening there, is questions of financial regulation in the United States. David Diane has written some really interesting pieces about that. We'll want to have him talk about after this. This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join in the conversation today, the toll-free number, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you'd rather send an email, then get on the phone. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC, the Tavis Smiley Show at noon, and then this afternoon at 1, Latino USA, here on KALW San Francisco. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. You can find information about the show at yourcallradio.org. We've got past shows archived. And I want to let you know, coming up on Monday, we're going to be having a conversation with Stephen Drucker about his new book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. And then on Tuesday, we're going to be marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina by talking with investigative journalist Gary Rivlin about his new book, Katrina, After the Flood. That's coming up next week. If you have a show idea for us, you're always welcome to drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org, where you can also send comments today on our Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm here with Kevin Hall. He is the chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, joining us from Washington, D.C., and David Diane, who is in Los Angeles. He's a contributing writer to Salon.com and the Fiscal Times. I wanted to pick up, Kevin, talking a little bit. I know you're a real watcher of the global economy and how it works. And this week, I think a lot of people have learned more about the Chinese economy and what a lot of people say is this kind of transition that's having to go through from being to really very resource-driven, both in terms of resources that come out of the ground and the labor of its people moving from the countryside into cities, to more of a consumer-based, maybe innovation-based economy, and that there's a lot of pains going on around that transition. Explain what you've come to understand about this, and then particularly the role of the Communist Party and the government there and what it's trying to do right now.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Pretty straightforward there. I do think that what the Chinese are up against in some degree is the limits of their own system, because there is so much intervention in the market and that things don't work off of cues. For starters, the Chinese stock market, that literally has nothing to do with the Chinese economy, in addition to the exposure of the average Chinese to the stock market is so very, very minimal. So in a real sense, China matters because it's 15% of global GDP.
And sorry, why do you say it's stock? I mean, even if, I mean, there may be some disconnect between the quote-unquote real economy in the United States and the stock market, but why do you think that's even a broader chasm in China?
Well, I think there is no real mechanism for valuing companies on the Chinese stock exchanges. They have several exchanges. In the U.S., there's all the market research. You see the earnings reports, the quarterly earnings. You have all kind of ways to verify that. There are laws against misleading on that. In China, there's virtually none of that, or certainly none of it in real enforceable terms. And why a company that gained X percent on the Chinese, on the Shanghai, why that would necessarily be the case based on fundamentals, you wouldn't know that. It doesn't operate like, you know, conventional stock market here in London or wherever. So it's very different, or even I'm thinking Brazil and the Bovespa, which is much more transparent. I think one of the little-known facts, I guess, in this crisis, or not crises, but in this these developments, it's actually it's been a virtuous cycle. Most of the developing world has a free-floating currency in which a devaluation naturally happens. Markets kind of make that happen, and it's a shock absorber. They can export more. They have more room. It kind of goes back to Greece not being able to do that because they're tied into the euro. So you have most of the emerging markets who are struggling, Brazil in particular struggling, but they have the mechanisms in place that it kind of functions normally. China doesn't. China has actually, you know, has massive reserves. They don't really report that much about what they do with these reserves, so you don't know actually how they're using them. And I think what triggered this crisis was the devaluation that caught everybody by surprise, whereas most central banks are, you know, kind of lead up to this, don't spring it on markets. This caught everybody by surprise. It was handled very poorly, but it speaks to the command and control part of that sooner or later, and they are trying to transition away from it, but it's not something you do overnight.
Well, are they trying to transition away from command and control, or from they're trying to control a movement to a different kind of economy, a different kind of basis for it, but not necessarily giving up that control?
Right, more domestic driven. And the million-dollar question is, does that in and of itself lead to a different kind of government structure? I have never found in China anyone in private conversations who's unhappy with their government, which is not to say that obviously we see on the news there are people, but in private conversations their legitimacy is growth. and that is their. That's why this is such a big deal in China now, and that's why I think their leaders are sweating, because they're struggling to grow at anywhere near past levels as they transition. And I think it does, for the average Chinese, call into the question their legitimacy to lead if they're not growing, if things aren't improving.
David, Diane, what have you been learning?
Yeah, I think Kevin knows a little bit more about this than I do, but from my vantage point, it seems that there's a battle within the Chinese government, the upper echelons, to figure out how to bring about this, soft landing on this change from a manufacturing-driven economy, a growth-driven economy, to a consumer-driven economy, and how much intervention needs to be done. I mean, the devaluation of the yuan was certainly a signal that they were going in a direction that was unclear to other people. I mean, I think that it was it struck the markets that China was in some more trouble than everyone thought. And that's why it did spur this significant volatility. And certainly with respect to the Chinese stock bubble, which China tried to intervene in all the way back in June and July, basically what happened over the last year is that ordinary Chinese were encouraged to get into the stock market using borrowed money. And they were encouraged very highly to do that. And I believe the number is something like 40 million people entered the stock market with borrowed money over the last year or so. I believe that's the number. And the stock market, even despite the 40-odd percent drop over the last 2 months, is still up 30, 40% over the last year. That's how high that bubble went up.
Yeah,
and that's how low it had, that's how farther it has to go. And you're seeing, because so much of this was bought with borrowed money, you're going to see margin calls, and you're going to see difficulty in paying back the arrears that are being generated. And it's an open question whether that will actually have an impact on individual Chinese to such a degree that it starts to weigh down the economy.
Yeah, and you do see the kind of proxies, and I think Chinese who have money and have the ability to travel have voted with their feet, have invested in California real estate, have invested in Vancouver, mm-hmm. and I think that in itself isn't just diversification. I think it's a question that their long-term bet, you can see where they're betting.
I want to bring in another listener, Harry in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Good morning. Yes, I wanted to comment on the fact that interest rates, these low interest rates, appear to be permanent unless the economy improves, and it's hard to see how the economy is going to improve given what the government and business are doing. And therefore, below the rate of inflation, which really affects both pension funds and people who have savings and forces people to seek out more things they can get a better return from, in which they may lose a lot of their principal, and it's quite dangerous in that aspect. But, so I was wondering if your guest could comment on what's going to happen if these interest rates go up, and what might force them to go up, because they won't go up because the economy is getting better as far as I can see.
David, you want to tackle, or you want me to tackle?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you kind of allude to this search for yield, which is, I think more dangerous on the part of investors, institutional investors, rather than ordinary individuals, and whether that is wreaking havoc with stability. I think the jury is out on that a little bit. It's kind of a careful what you wish for. If you're wishing for interest rates to go up, which might help savers at the margin, but might have effects on jobs and effects on employment and effects on what companies decide to do. So the Federal Reserve has definitely gotten itself with this very long time frame of a zero interest rate environment into something of a pickle. I don't know if it's as big as the pickle China's in, but it's certainly something where they're going to have to figure out how to manage this very carefully to get this return to normalcy. And the first test we'll see is early in September at the Fed's monthly meeting, where they will decide whether or not to make a liftoff and the first rise on the federal funds rate.
Yeah, return to normalcy historically has been 3 to 5%.
Right. Not, we're nowhere near there.
we've been since 2001, post 9/11, have been at 2% or under. So right. We've been, more than a decade, certainly almost a decade and a half now, at these historically low rates. And I've written about this, and I try to raise this at any point I can, that people have gotten we have an entire generation who thinks money is free, pretty close to free, and by historical standards. And it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves, or how are people going to feel about a 6% mortgage rate if they're paying 3.75 now. I mean, the psychology of it all is going to be interesting to watch unfold.
Well, we certainly saw that early on, like just last year when the so-called taper tantrum happened, and long-term mortgage rates did go up a little bit, and that did have an effect on the housing market. So there is going to be a significant shakeout with that. The question is, if the Fed is missing its inflation target 3 years running, is there any urgency to raise interest rates?
David Diane is a contributing writer to Salon.com. Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable, where we invite you to join the conversation with your questions, your comments, your observations about coverage of the week's news. And in particular, we're talking about the economic slowdown in China, the state of the American economy, and what, if anything, we learned from coverage of the big stock market downturn at the beginning of this week. The number to call if you want to join the conversation is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I guess a question that I have, we talk about the health of the economy as a unitary thing almost, but when we have what we've had in recent years in the United States, where corporate profits basically, reasonably strong, or at least strong enough to drive a real bull market in the stock arena, and at the same time, really stagnant wages that seem to kind of basically be why the economy doesn't really get going, because there's just not enough demand there. And then in some ways, a lot of people say that's some of what's happened in China, right? There's been a huge amount of money that's gone into capital investment, and obviously some people have gotten very rich there, but actually the people who are supposed to become the future consumers aren't really feeling that capacity to be involved in the economy in that way. Do we need to kind of just rechange the way we talk about, here's what's happening with the economy?
Well, one thing they did there, I'll jump in here on that, one thing they didn't do was have a stimulus and a government stimulus check like we had at the start of our crisis. Because the Chinese are notorious savers. One of their challenges is getting people to spend because they don't have much of a social safety net, so their historical tendency as a consumer is to tighten the belt. So that is kind of one of the interesting, beyond transitioning to more consumption, is to change people's habits there. So I think that's part of it. But on our end, on the income, I was watching CNBC the other morning when Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor running for president, was on, and was slamming Obama for being the president of the one percenters and noting how the 1% have done so much better under Obama. And it was kind of like being in a parallel universe to watch that. But it's going to be a campaign theme on both sides. Both sides here seem to at least acknowledge it now, which is an advancement. But what you do about it at a time when corporations continue to be bumping around near corporate profits, they have record amounts of cash overseas, and wages continue to be stagnant, something's got to give, and it's going to be one of the key campaign themes next year.
But, I thought it was interesting. I mean, there were a couple examples of, after the stock market downturn, a couple of candidates kind of coming out, Scott Walker saying Obama should rescind his invitation for Xi Jinping to come to Washington, this kind of thing. Of course, Donald Trump had something to say. But in some ways, it struck me that there actually wasn't as much grabbing onto this moment as there might have been.
Say again? I didn't get...
And so I said that the candidates, Democrat and Republican, didn't seem to jump in to this moment of the stock downturn and the kind of sense of just instability that people felt earlier this week. I don't know. That was my sense that, in fact, it was a little muted.
Huckabee did. Huckabee jumped in and blamed Obama and said, when in fact, my editor actually did tweeted on this after checking the numbers. Stocks were up 99.9% from Obama's first day of office at the low point on Monday.
Right.
And Huckabee was the only one to tweet. It was all Obama's fault.
Yeah, certainly people are going to be opportunistic like that. But, if you talk about market volatility, maybe there's nothing more volatile right now than the presidential races and the rise of Donald Trump and the enthusiasm on the Democratic side of the spectrum with Bernie Sanders. And I think some of what's driving that is some of what you're talking about, the fact that wages have not kept up with productivity for the last 40 years, the fact that there's this wage stagnation and tremendous anxiety over retirement, over job security, over things of that nature, is driving a lot of this unease and anxiousness. And I think if we do see volatility continue over the next year or so, which is certainly possible and maybe likely, it only feeds that a little bit more. And, if we are at a point where people are talking about inequality, they're putting tentative solutions on the table. I'm not sure anyone has really nailed it yet, but I think that's going to be certainly a large conversation as we head into 2016.
Let's hear from Jim in Oakland who wanted
hang up and then
guess we won't be talking to Jim right now. So maybe I'll follow up with you, David. I wanted to talk about, earlier we were talking about the way that the borrowed money leveraging was being used to drive up the stock market in China. You actually have reported recently about the ways in which there's some loosening on the rules about use of leverage in the stock market in the U.S.
Well, potential loosening, and it's more about leverage rules for banks.
Okay.
The one of the major post financial crisis reforms, and this was not necessarily from Dodd-Frank, but from the international banking process known as Basel III, was a leverage ratio, and this is just a flat ratio of total Tier 1 capital, which is stock earnings and retained earnings, as a percentage of total assets. So it's there's no risk weighting or anything like that. And big banks want to reduce that leverage ratio by reducing the denominator, by taking certain things out of the assets part of that equation. That way they don't have to hold on to as much capital. There's a big fight over this. The head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Tim Massad, is on the side of the banks on this one because they want to reduce, take out of the asset equation collateral that is that they capture from investors on derivatives trades. The FDIC, particularly Tom Hanig, who is a pretty big champion of leverage, thinks that this would undermine the entire leverage ratio and make things riskier. It would allow banks to capture more profits because you can capture more profits with borrowed money than with equity, but it would increase risk, according to Hanig. And so this has already been rejected once by the federal banking regulators and the international banking regulators, but according to Bloomberg, they're taking a second bite at the apple here. And it's kind of an example of since Gary Gensler left, who was seen as pretty hard charging against the banks, it seems like the rules on derivatives have been loosened somewhat by his replacement, which is his name is Timothy Massad. He was a former Treasury official. So it remains to be seen whether this particular thing will change, but obviously I did use the example of the Chinese stock market as an example of the dangers of excessive leverage, and my opinion would be to err on the side of caution when you're talking about loosening the leverage rules.
Sounds like we've got Jim in Oakland back. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, on Monday and Tuesday morning on World Have Your Say, the BBC put a lot on the China situation. And then I felt kind of relieved because my mom just moved into a residential community, had to sell her townhouse to be able to pay the rent in this retirement place. And so now she's in stocks because her financial advisor said bonds aren't like they were 10 years ago as a safer alternative, because there's nothing unless you really want 10 or 15 years. So we didn't do bonds. So all of a sudden my mom's in stocks, and then this happens, and the BBC analysis put a lot of it on China and their increased focus on building domestic higher end goods and pushing more of their low end production to India and Southeast Asia, as they realize they've got, you know, such a large population, they don't need as much emphasis on exports. And so then on Democracy Now, they had an economist on Tuesday who made me see the current problem more related to unresolved issues that go back to 2008 here, and the way Obama, they didn't name Obama, but the way he brought Sumners and others, the architects of the problem, in to solve the problem, and that it hasn't been resolved, kind of along the lines some of what you were just saying. So all of this is tied together. I'm like telling my mom not to be worried, and then I'm not worried, and then I'm a little more worried, and then how separate is the China problem from what we're facing, and how much it is of the problems here are really just unresolved issues related to the problems of the last 8 or 10 years here.
Great question, Jim. Let's get both Kevin and then David to chime in.
I think his reference to Sumners in the past was that several people in this administration, including Gensler, recently referenced, were all part of the Clinton administration in the late 90s and were all part of a Treasury Department that went along with doing away with Glass-Steagall and allowing this kind of huge expansion and, you know, breaking down the firewall between investor money and bank money and allowing it to be commingled, and that was a big part of it. Are we back there? I mean, I think Dodd-Frank is going to be awfully hard to overturn in its entirety. But as David rightly noted, it's being chipped away at every single day in every single way, much like the tax code was right after the 86 reform. But the big thing to keep in mind, I guess, for your caller is that legislation always, you know, fixes the last battle, not the one that's next. And I suspect what will get us into trouble won't be the things that got us into trouble in the past.
David?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Certainly there are potential trouble spots on the horizon, particularly around high-yield debt, corporate loans, particularly energy loans with oil prices going down. A lot of energy loans have come in poorly. There are these things called collateralized loan obligations that are basically versions of the collateralized debt obligations that were used in mortgage-backed securities during the crisis. A lot of them have high-yield energy debt in them. This goes back to the sort of reach for yield that we were talking about, people looking for better return on their money. And some of them have been failing. I don't know if it's an issue that in any way comes close to what we saw in 2008 at this point. But as was referenced, certainly the rules when Dodd-Frank was really not necessarily a law, but a promise to write a bunch of laws later, and those rules are being written, and some of them are being written in favor of the central banking, not central bank, but the banking interests on Wall Street. And that's definitely concerning. I mean, we kind of haven't really taken out Dodd-Frank for a test drive yet. It hasn't been in a volatile situation where the safeguards would really be needed to be used, and that's kind of the great unknown we're dealing with.
We've got about 2 minutes left in the program, and I want to get your response to a listener who's took me to task in an email. He says, his name is Gregory. He says, Matt just said something completely insane, comparing us U.S. stagnant wages versus the China economy. That is insane. The U.S. oligopoly is driving the masses into poverty while the Chinese communist government is pulling millions out of poverty. They actually have a real economy. Get it? So that's the question. What do you think, Kevin?
After you, David.
You know, the Chinese economy is really kind of a black box to me. I mean, it's hard to know exactly where they're going. If it is the case, and I believe it is the case, that the Chinese economy is moving away from mercantilism and toward a more consumer-based economy, then what the emailer is talking about is where China is kind of headed. So, you know, it's hard to often get a read on the Chinese economy. It's hard to actually know if the statistics that are put out don't have the thumb on the scale. But I tend to think that the answer is probably somewhere in the middle of the in between the what the caller was saying on both sides, whether it's the United States or China.
Yeah. Kevin, and you're free. I just want to make it clear, you're free to say that. Yes, indeed, I am insane. So I just
I
want to open that
given.
Up. Yeah, okay.
I think that's a given.
Or and being half sane is being half insane as well. But I just wouldn't even begin to agree with that. The U.S. economy continues to be the most sophisticated, the greatest access, the ability to start from nothing, the ability to borrow money. Yes, things are tough at the bottom end for sure. And yes, the bottom end has been growing in size relative to the growing wealth of the top end. But those are questions about return on an education and access to education. And again, every time I visit manufacturers around the country, and I try to do that to visit real people and real jobs, every manager tells me the biggest problem I have is people who aren't on drugs and who come to work every day. Those are social issues, not business issues.
That's McClatchy Chief Economics Correspondent Kevin Hall. We've also been joined for the hour by Salon contributor David Diane. You can check out their work at our website, yourcallradio.org. Great to have you both with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Thanks for listening. When it comes to genetically modified foods, has the FDA failed in its responsibility to protect the public? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with public interest attorney Stephen Drucker about his new book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. Drucker says that if the FDA had listened to its own experts' advice about the risks posed by GMO foods, they would have never gained traction. How did genetically modified foods pass the safety test? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Ruz is on as senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. We're online at kalw.org. Coming up next, World Have Your Say from the BBC, a program that was recorded earlier this morning for broadcast at this time. It's 11 o'clock, and this is 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Local Public Radio.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say on the BBC. I'm Ben James. Welcome to the programme. Join in as you listen on Facebook, Twitter and WhatsApp.
This, we believe, underscores the ruthlessness of people smugglers who have expanded their business from the Mediterranean Sea to the highways of Europe.
More tragedies in Europe's migration crisis. Dozens dead in a lorry in Austria. Hundreds feared dead in a boat off Libya. We'll hear from both places as we continue to tell the stories. Now, these are some of the consequences of what's happening. What about the solutions? Lots of people are pitching ideas. We'll hear some and talk them through. You can share yours at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, what's it like to be raised by gay parents? There's a conversation in Australia about a documentary about same-sex parenting. We'll hear people share their experiences.